Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a look at some new acquisitions at Gilcrease Museum, which provides an end to just how the museum University of Tulsa partnership between the city-owned museum and the private research university, which manages and operates the facility, works. Today, we'll hear about a recent gift to the museum, a series of 50 or so stereoscopic photographs created during the filming of the 1930 Western The Big Trail, which not only adds to the vast collection of memorabilia art of the Western America in the Gilcrease collection, but offers additional opportunities for study and scholarship at the university. Stereoscopic photos provided a 3D effect when seen through a special viewer. Think of a GAF Viewmaster. They were popular during the late 19th century and early 20th century, but by 1930 it wasn't a common practice. The film The Big Trail is also interesting in its way. Though a commercial failure, it was selected to the Library of Congress's National Film Registry. Somewhat of an experimental film. It was shot in 70mm, big budget, the first big budget outdoor film spectacle in the sound era, created just a couple years after the first sound motion picture, and it was filmed on location in 6 Western states. It was also the first film that featured John Wayne under his own name as a star, along with Marguerite Churchill, who was the mother of the late University of Tulsa professor Darcy O'Brien. I'm joined today by Mark Dolphin, Associate Curator of History at the Gilcrease Museum, along with Justin Rollins, an Assistant Professor of Communications and Film Studies at the University of Tulsa. He's actually teaching a class on the history of the American Western this semester. And we'll hear about the collection and how it adds to both the scholarly research at the university as well as the enjoyment to the average visitor to Gilcrease Museum. Mark and Justin, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, Mark, let me ask you, the Gilcrease Museum is always adding to its collections, and one of the new collections that have come to the museum is a really interesting set of stereographic photographs of a filming of John Wayne's first film under the name John Wayne. Mm-hmm. He was probably Marion Morrison in a couple of films prior, but this was his first big role as John Wayne for a relatively forgotten film, The Big Trail. First of all, what are stereographic photographs, for those who don't know what those are?
Stereographic or stereoscopic images are two images, two photographs that are set on a card side by side and requires a viewer. If you and I, being of a certain age, probably remember the Viewmasters.
Where yes, the GAF Viewmasters.
It provides that three-dimensional, very realistic view of whatever the scene is. Well, that's what the stereoscopic cards, images were all about, to provide a more lifelike, realistic portrayal of whatever you were looking at.
Really? And how popular were they in the first part of this last century? I know that some of the great Western photographers would do this as well.
Yes, they were very popular in the 19th century into the early 20th century. Now, Justin's more the film expert here, but I have to believe by 1930, this was something just not that common, not that popular. So we were speculating earlier that why stereoscopic images for these behind-the-scene images from this movie? And perhaps the person that took these still photographs was a fan of that technology, enjoyed the realism that it provided, and creates these.
Now, is it actually two separate shots of the image?
It's two separate shots, and they're slightly offset. So effectively what you're doing is tricking the brain into lending depth to the image. So it's an optical illusion.
But just 3D. Yeah. It's, you know, yeah. I mean, if you actually go to a 3D movie, mm-hmm. you see two images offset.
Yeah, it's virtual reality before VR, right?
So why do you expect that they made these photographs? Because this seems like, you know, when you look at films from the 1930s, you have people like George Harrell and all these sort of people that you sort of expect to be taking glamour shots of the actors as promotional material.
Right.
Why these stereographic photographs?
It's a great question. And in my experience researching films of this era and John Wayne films in particular, I haven't encountered a lot of these. So behind the scenes shots are used, production stills are used to promote films, but using the stereographic cards, the stereoscopic images, to speak to what Mark was saying a few minutes ago, I think the fact that we don't see very many of these around film suggests that they may be more of a hobbyist pastime by this point, although we're not actually that far away from attempts at 3D film. So it's interesting that this is kind of situated in between these two different periods of three-dimensional imagery.
And this actually gets back to the idea of what was interesting about The Big Trail, other than it being John Wayne's first film, mm-hmm. was this was really an ambitious film.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, it began with a budget of $1.5 million in 1930, which sounds like a pittance today, but at the time,
that was a big budget
first
film.
Year of yeah. the Great Depression, they went over budget, over $2 million. But as Justin and I were discussing earlier, you see it on the screen.
It's all
you
there.
You see
yeah.
it on the screen. This cast, literally a thousand, whether it's the human cast, the animals, the oxen, the horses, the bison, using Native Americans in appropriate roles, mm-hmm. something that by the 50s and 60s, they weren't doing.
Right.
It's a interesting film in all kinds of ways. Back to this question of why stereoscopic images. Well, here's an opportunity to bring this partnership between the University of Tulsa and Gilcrease Museum together and try to answer it. Mm-hmm. That we have the strength of the film department here, and this is a great research project.
Oh, absolutely.
That mm-hmm. not only do we have the assets, these stereographic images, but we have the person that donated them to the museum has a connection to the lead actress, Marguerite Churchill. So we have this living connection to a film that's now almost 90 years old.
Yeah.
And so we can have that opportunity to peel back the layers, and maybe through that process we'll come to an understanding.
And what does that add to the museum experience, just from a museum goer's standpoint, of having this research university involved with that, where you can sort of flesh out some of these stories?
It brings resources, intellectual firepower to the museum that with our staff we would otherwise not have available to us. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have two curators, mm-hmm. but there is a whole campus intellect and knowledge and experience that we can draw on. So I think when President Upham brought this opportunity to the university, to the city of Tulsa, to form this partnership, finding these kinds of connections was paramount in this decision. And in my opinion, the partnership has in many ways saved the museum as we know it and has allowed it to prosper. Mm-hmm. In all kinds of ways.
And I assume it also adds more opportunities for students, for student researchers, for people who may be looking at a career either in academics or at least in some sort of facet of research. This gives you a great opportunity for a student to actually flesh out this story.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, speaking as a film scholar and a historian, artifacts, objects, these primary materials are tremendous teaching and research tools, not only for my own work and for the work of others in the community, but also just for helping students to touch the past, to engage with the past, and to think about sometimes in the case of these images, for example, how, you know, what is old is new again, right? There are a lot of continuities, a lot of threads that allow them to gain some particular insights into the past that they didn't have before. So, for example, I'm teaching a class on the Western film right now, and mm-hmm. you know, we're teaching The Big Trail in a few weeks, so we'll be talking about these images as well and thinking about what it means to convey spaces and to tell stories through images, things like that. So it's a multifaceted tool.
Now, you were chatting before we started and said, you know, The Big Trail is a tremendously underrated film.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like you consider it to be sort of a great Western in many ways.
Well, I don't know if I would say it's a great Western. It's not one of my favorite Westerns, but I think it's tremendously underrated. I mean, I came in to my work on John Wayne through, like most people, through Stagecoach,
right?
Because that's often, it's canonical as his star-making film. And that probably is the case. I mean, he gets higher profile films after that, so that seems to make sense. But when you watch The Big Trail and you read about what went into it and why it likely did not succeed, what you come away with is a sense of just how far ahead of its time it is. And that's what I mean by saying it's underrated. I think that they were doing things that weren't normal for 30 or 40 years. And the conditions didn't exist for people to accept it financially, probably more than anything else, but also technologically.
They were shooting on 70 millimeter film, correct?
Yeah, it was part of an experimental new format called the, I believe it was called the Grandeur.
Grandeur.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
The Grandeur process. And unfortunately, this is just a year, almost a year to the day after the stock market crash. You're in the midst of the Great Depression. Only two theaters in the entire country have the means to exhibit this format. One in New York, one in LA, unsurprisingly. And so that doesn't bode well for your bottom line. So they did also shoot it in 35 millimeter, but my understanding is that it really was shot. It was framed. It
for
was
70
composed to be appreciated in 70 millimeter.
It's kind of like when you watch the great Panavision films on a old-fashioned television. You know,
right.
Everything's squished and half the scene's gone.
Right. Suddenly everyone's a lot thinner, a lot lankier.
Exactly.
Well, and John Wayne is pretty lanky in this.
Oh my gosh,
with.
Is he ever?
Interestingly, the 70 millimeter version is about 2 hours in length. The 35 millimeter is about an hour and 20 minutes in length.
Oh, wow.
So there's a great discrepancy between the two.
And that was probably a commercial consideration. A two-hour film in those days was a long film because you had newsreels, cartoons, shorts. Then your feature, and a feature was about an hour and a half usually, tops.
Well, and we were talking about how what was old is new again. Think about the resurgence of Westerns here in the last decade. When I was growing up, and I was born in 1958, Westerns were what we watched, whether it was on television or at the theater. And then those pretty much disappeared. But over the last decade, we've had many good Westerns.
Yeah. And the other thing about this film, though, was interesting is that, you know, most of the time, and the Westerns you reference in your childhood, they were all shot out in the back lots and just outside of L.A. This film was on location in what, four states?
Five states.
Yeah, they shot
along the Oregon Trail, right? Because this is what the story's about, a trip on the Oregon Trail. And they actually tried to go along the Oregon Trail as much as they could.
With flashbacks to the Santa Fe Trail, the Santa Fe fur trade. It's part of the John Wayne character's motivation is to find who killed his partner and stole his furs down in the Santa Fe area. So part of it filming is in New Mexico.
So one of the most compelling images that the Gilcrease has is of the Teton Pass, which if you've ever driven it, even now, you know, in the 21st century, it's a pretty scary drive. And so I believe it's maybe a Model T or Model A or something that's, you know, stuck in a snowdrift on this pass. Because they're filming in the Teton Pass, which is extraordinary. So again, in terms of canonical Westerns, Stagecoach is often talked about as being so monumental in part because it was shot on location, right? And it kind of helped to make Monument Valley this iconic place for situating Westerns. But you know, nearly 10 years before, you have the Big Trail, which is shooting all over the American West, which is tremendous. Again, it's we were marveling beforehand that, you know, in 2016 or 2017 dollars, this film cost about $28 million. Mm-hmm. And if you were to try to shoot that what the Big Trail does now, that you wouldn't even, you'd be doing many, many, many times that. You'd be spending so much money.
Probably at least a zero or two more.
It's extraordinary.
Well, and they're moving, again, this literally cast of thousands, but it's not just the human cast. There are the cattle, the oxen, the horses, the bison. Mm-hmm. So all of this is moved on railroad cars throughout the West. In fact, the actors stayed. They lived in railroad cars as the film was produced.
Really?
In fact, the...
it's like a circus.
Well, I'm sure at times it probably was. In fact...
These images themselves, if I may interrupt for a second, is they're sort of background. Like as Justin mentioned, seeing a car stuck in a snowdrift. They're sort of behind-the-scenes look at the film.
Well, there's both. Those very behind-the-scenes kind of shots, but there are also images that could be turned into a poster to promote the film. The Indian attack on the wagon train. There are images. John Wayne and Marguerite Churchill, the two leads, coming together in a very romantic moment would have been a perfect poster to promote the movie.
Yeah. Which is one of the things that I find so fascinating is it makes me wonder, like, if some of these images were made into posters that we just haven't found yet. I mean, these you know, this motion picture ephemera is often so difficult to track down, as we all know, especially for a film that is now going on almost 90 years old.
Yeah.
So, you know, it makes you wonder what kind of life these images may have had that we might be able to find out or we might never know.
How will the museum use a particular gift like this? I mean, I could see it coming out as part of a exhibition that looks at the history of the Western or some facet of the Westerns. How will the museum use a gift like this?
That's a great question, Rich. I think there's several ways. First, on a really elemental level, people are always asking, what's new? Mm-hmm. And you could do a very nice exhibition on recent donations, gifts, acquisitions that the museum has made. These could be a part of that. People are just interested in knowing what's been added to the collection. But I think a more valuable way to use them would be, and Justin could help in this regard, putting together an exhibition that shows how Western film has helped create an American identity. Whether it's realistic or not, those films have had a very powerful influence on how we see ourselves as mm-hmm. Americans and how the rest of the world sees us as America, the John Wayne kind of image.
It was really interesting. We just had one of Justin's colleagues on last week, John Coward,
right,
who did his latest book is about the Illustrated Indian, and it was a lot of the really early mid-19th century illustrations of Indians. And you look at some of these illustrations, you go, this looks like a storyboard for a 30s or 40s Western. And it probably was.
It becomes, mm-hmm. yes.
Yeah.
Well, and so you take these images from the Big Trail and maybe you juxtapose them with images from the 101 Ranch Collection, where they're actually performing this very nostalgic life show to audiences not only here in the United States but in Europe, mm-hmm. using, again, real Native people in these roles. Yes, it's very stereotyped, mm-hmm. very contrived in many ways, but it's presenting this narrative that becomes the American story.
Of course, you have to remember the 101 Ranch was also making films, too.
Yes, they will move into films.
Yeah. My guest today is Mark Dolph, Associate Curator of History at the Gilcrease Museum, Justin Rollins, Assistant Professor of Communications and also in Film Studies at the University of Tulsa. So we talk about Gilcrease's one of their most recent gifts, a collection of stereoscopic photographs taken during the filming of the 1930 movie The Big Trail, which was John Wayne's first movie under that using that name rather than his given name. And it's just one of a number of gifts at the Gilcrease that have been coming in. I guess you guys are either purchasing or having donations to the museum all the time. What are some of the other things that have been added to the collection?
And you mentioned purchasing. We would love to purchase more. Budgets don't really allow that. So we really depend in many ways on these wonderful gifts. The Big Trail is a gift. It was given to the museum. Recently, one that has a great backstory is a painting by the Taos artist, E.I. Kaus. And the story behind it is that our volunteer group, the Gillies, had taken an outreach program to a retirement facility in Sand Springs. And in the audience is the woman who owned this painting by Kaus that was purchased by her father in 1929 for $150.
Wow.
Actually, with the gift came the canceled check.
Right.
So we have that documentation.
Wow,
that's the kind of provenance and documentation you love to have. And so she's sitting there, she hears this presentation on the Tao Society of Artists and decides, I want to gift this to the museum. We only have two cows in the collection. Now we have three. So we've added by 50% our cows collection. Last summer, someone called and said, I have some field glasses, binoculars, and have been told they belong to a Civil War general. Now, most Civil War material always belongs to a Civil War general or a Confederate general, Union general.
That's right. Well, if you just watch the Antiques Roadshow, you know that everything from every sword and every piece of memorabilia belonged to not just a soldier, but a famous soldier.
A famous soldier.
Yeah.
So this person brought them in. We looked at it. They're definitely of the period. They're mid to late 19th century field glasses, optics, mm-hmm. and they have a name carved into the outer rim of one of the lenses. Very intriguing. Now, we don't know for sure who that is. There's another research project. But we didn't have anything like that in the collection. Mm-hmm. So if we're going to have maybe a painting of the Civil War and you see a General Grant, well, it's great to have an artifact from the period. Even if it didn't belong to General Grant, it's nice to have it there to add another layer of experience for the viewer.
So you can't leave us hanging. What's the name on the...
Well, the name is a was a Union general that served with Custer in the cavalry. The name is Gibson. We don't know. We can't prove. It's going to take a lot of research.
You can't authenticate
it. And we may still,
yeah,
at the end of the day, say we just don't know.
Could but be attributed to him, or it is an artifact of the era.
But for me, it's more important the fact that we have this artifact that adds meaning or the experience of a guest looking at something in the collection, a painting or so forth. Recently, one of our great benefactors here in Tulsa, who supported the museum in all kinds of ways for years, donated three paintings, one of which, for me, the most exciting was a Maynard Dixon. Oh. Maynard Dixon is one of the premier early 20th century artists of the American experience, American West.
And that's an artist that I don't think Gilchrist has ever
had. We did not have any.
Yeah.
So, and you think about when Thomas Gilchrist was collecting, it was the first third into the middle of the 20th century when Dixon was active. Why don't we have any? Because it's the kind of art, the subject matter and so forth, genre that Gilchrist was attracted to. Mm-hmm. Now we have a Maynard Dixon. But also in the gift was an Ed Mell, late 20th century Cubist landscape artist, very contemporary.
He's actually a Cubist Western American artist, which is real. I mean, not Cubism the way you'd see in Picasso, but that it's influenced by that. And it's really amazing work.
So that's going to be a great addition. We're known for these landscapes, but for the most part, they're mid to late 19th century.
They're realistic.
Very realistic. And for the most part, that's what Gilchrist collected. I asked myself, would Gilchrist today have bought Ed Mell?
Yeah.
I would argue maybe so, because we have to remember that Gilchrist died in 1962. And much of what he was collecting in the latter part of his life, 40s or so, was modern for its time. You think about the works of Willard Stone.
Yeah.
Willard Stone was kind of out there in a lot of ways. The Mexican art in the collection is very modern. And a lot of the Native American material is of its day, the middle part of the 20th century.
And so will those be up on the walls soon? Or when can we expect to see some of these things?
Well, as you know, the citizens of Tulsa voted to tax themselves, to extend an existing tax, to help fund an expansion of the museum. Right now, it looks like that expansion where we would have to close the museum is probably about 3 years off, probably at a minimum 3 years off. So we're now planning the exhibition schedule for 2019, and we have talked about utilizing some of this new material in all kinds of ways. Maybe it's this kind of juxtaposition, an Ed Mell sitting beside a William Keith or a Thomas Moran landscape. Mm-hmm. So ways to do that. I do want, it's a great question, and I want to emphasize right now, these images from the big trail are not on the walls.
Right.
We have
right.
had people, members that read the story in the latest member magazine, and they came out, I want to see the big trail. I'm sorry, it's actually, this process of receiving donations is lengthy, and because we are owned by the city of Tulsa, the final approval comes through city council. And while my mother said, never use always and never, I think these will come into the collection. It's pretty much a certainty they will. But until they do, we really can't display them in a public way. So, and because exhibition schedules are often very extended, it's probably going to be a couple years before we get these up. But if we can find a way to display them sooner, we're pushing for that.
It sounds like the collection is always growing. As large as Gilchrist, you know, as many things as Gilchrist collected, the collection still continues to grow. And it sounds like these stereoscopic photographs will add meaning to some of the collection that's already in place. And it's always great to see new art coming into the Gilchrist.
Yes, it is. We don't want to be frozen in time. We need to continue to collect.
Well, Mark Dolph and Justin Rollins, thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Justin Rollins is an assistant professor of communications at the University of Tulsa. Mark Dolph is the associate curator of history at Gilcrease Museum. So we talked about some recent additions to the extensive collections at Gilcrease Museum. While these acquisitions are coming into the museum, they are not yet on display. You can learn more at gilcrease.org. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Jeff Nix and Janet Pearson.
Teachers and public education are hot topics these days, and it's been decades since we were in school, so we can hardly comment on the way teachers and schools are these days. But looking back, we can certainly say that a lot's changed since we were public school students, and add that hopefully a lot's changed since our early school years.
For example, back in our day, teachers were basically feared and revered. Feared because they could actually whack you if they thought you were a behavior problem.
In my formative years, if a teacher whacked a student, the student would then go to the vice principal's office where the vice principal whacked you, then you went home where your folks whacked you, and if your parents, close friends, relatives, or neighbors were around, they whacked you.
And how would you know about that?
Oh, never mind about that.
Nowadays, of course, if a teacher whacks a student, the teacher goes to jail and the student and parents go to the lawyer's office.
That's why teachers were feared. Why were they revered? In our early school years, we believed that teachers knew everything because they told us they knew everything, and we believed them.
For example, in the 50s and 60s, we went through the atom bomb fear years. There was great public concern then that Russia was always just a few minutes away from dropping an atom bomb on America, and somehow it fell to the public school systems to teach kids about what to do if Russia dropped the big one on us.
I remember we viewed grainy black-and-white films with a skippy soundtrack that outlined what to do if the atom bomb was dropped while we were in school. First, we were told to get under our desks. In later years, we were told to head for the hallway and crouch by the lockers, like either getting under a wooden desk or out in the hallway would do any good at all.
Later, we were told that if there was an atomic blast while we were outdoors, we should stop, drop, and roll. Good general advice if you're on fire. A few years later, after additional scholarly research, we were told that we should cover the backs of our necks with our hands while crouching on the floor. That should protect our sensitive necks and noggins from harm. Indeed.
Did these teachers not know that the temperature of an atomic blast is hotter than the sun, which is some 15 million degrees? And did they not know that an atomic bomb blast wave travels at the speed of sound?
Did those same teachers who were teaching us science, mathematics, physics, and chemistry just not know that our first indication of an atom bomb blast would be a wall of millions of degrees of heat traveling at the speed of sound, destroying everything in its path? Try to stop, drop, and roll your way out of that.
I mean, didn't teachers go to school? Wouldn't their teachers have mentioned 15 million degrees of heat in an atomic blast? Or did they know all along that there was basically no chance of survival, but that we students needed to be told that we could survive an atom bomb? And who decided that all other school topics should be taught credibly, just not atomic bomb safety?
In conclusion, the public education system back in our day was designed to be partly truth, partly fiction, all taught with the same seriousness, plus good old physical discipline, all of which was designed to show us something, but we're just not sure what.
I mean, remember, these were the same people who told us that in later life we would be constantly using algebra, long division, slide rules, we'd be conjugating verbs, and we'd be tasked to know that the Battle of Hastings was in 1066, wherever the heck Hastings might be.
Jeff Nix and Janet Pearson are husband and wife and regular contributors to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.